If it's Friday, ballooning crisis with Beijing. Distrust grows and relations further deteriorate between the U.S. and China as Pentagon officials and the Secretary of State provide new details on the suspected Chinese spy balloon spotted flying over the continental United States. Plus, it's not just the economy. President Biden touts a surprisingly strong jobs report today ahead of his biggest political speech since the midterms. As our latest NBC News poll shows, the president has a polling problem heading into 2024. And NBC News exclusive reporting that more than a million migrants who crossed the U.S. border in the last 2 years don't have a court date. And thousands are now untraceable. We don't know where they are. Happy Friday and welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Chuck Todd reporting from Washington. The United States, the deteriorating relationship with China crumbled even further today. Any hopes of tamping down tensions between the countries is also diminishing. The State Department announced today that Secretary Blinken will not be visiting China next week. It was a planned visit. All of this cancellation has to do with the suspected Chinese spy balloon that has been spotted over the continental United States. Moments ago, Secretary Blinken, alongside his South Korean counterpart, discussed the situation.
In my call today with Director Wang Yi, I made clear that the presence of this surveillance balloon in U.S. airspace is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law, that it's an irresponsible act, and that the PRC's decision to take this action on the eve of my planned visit is detrimental to the substantive discussions that we were prepared to have. I told Director Wang that the United States remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that I plan to visit Beijing when conditions allow.
Secretary Blinken said the U.S. is confident this is a Chinese surveillance balloon. You heard the expression just now. But further details about it, including its purpose and its capabilities, remain unclear. This video was recorded by an eyewitness in Billings, Montana on Wednesday. It's the same day the Pentagon says the balloon passed through that area. Pentagon today said the balloon is now moving eastward across the United States, flying at about 60,000 feet. There were reports a couple hours ago that it was seen in Kansas City. Now, China claims the balloon is a civilian airship that is simply studying weather. It's a claim that the senior Pentagon officials have denied.
We are aware of the PRC's statement. However, the fact is we know that it's a surveillance balloon, and I'm not going to be able to be more specific than that. We do know that the balloon has violated U.S. airspace and international law, which is unacceptable. And so we've conveyed this directly to the PRC at multiple levels. And in terms of specific locations, I'm not going to be able to go into specific locations again, other than to say it's moving eastward.
Speaker McCarthy is calling this, quote, a, quote, destabilizing action and has requested a briefing for the Gang of Eight, the sort of the congressional leaders and the heads of the intel chairs that get classified intelligence briefing, though their staffs were given a classified briefing late yesterday on this situation. Several Republicans are saying the Biden administration should have already shot the balloon down, which the Pentagon says it is opting against, at least for now.
I still have unanswered questions about why we chose not to shoot it down. I'm not sure I'm persuaded by the argument that the debris was the issue.
That's the question on every American's mind this morning is why hasn't the Biden administration shot the spy balloon down? This is the first time in my lifetime I've ever seen anything like this.
It's very concerning they didn't shoot it out of the air before it even reached the continental United States.
Democratic Senator John Tester, who obviously represents Montana, where the balloon was first spotted, is calling this incident a provocation that is completely unacceptable. And as I said, this incident with the balloon comes amid a growing mutual distrust between the two superpowers. And the United States has been expanding our military presence in the region. In fact, just this week, the U.S. and the Philippines announced plans to expand America's military presence in that country, including increased access to military bases. And just last week, an Air Force general predicted we'd be at war with China by 2025. So was this balloon a response from China? Was it a provocation? Is it a bit of both? And what happens now? Obviously, all of that remains to be seen, but we're going to go deep on this story. So joining me now is NBC News Pentagon correspondent Courtney Kuby. We've got Janice Mackey Frayer, who is live for us in Beijing. Courtney, let me start with you. Where is the balloon right now? Are we tracking it, and have we completely ruled out shooting it down if it gets over water in the next couple of days?
So we don't know exactly where it is, other than it's still over the continental U.S. and it's moving east. We know Wednesday it was over Billings, Montana. There have been reports, as you said, that it may have flown or been near Kansas City. We're still working to try to verify that. But what we do know is it's still over the continental U.S. And that's critical here, because while there have been cases in the past where Chinese balloons like this have made their way to the U.S. and even breached U.S. airspace, what's so different about this instance is it's been hovering there for several days, and it's maneuvering, again, making its way towards, close to, in some cases, strategic U.S. assets. That's why there's so much concern about this balloon from the U.S. You asked about whether the U.S. could shoot it down. Absolutely, that's still on the table. Officials who I'm speaking with here continue to say that they are very concerned about the debris field. And I want to point out just how enormous this balloon is. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of two school buses in size. So when you consider the fact that there's most likely helium involved in it, if they were to somehow take it out with any kind of an explosion, it could be a potentially enormous explosion. That's why the debris field could be so big here, and that's why the officials are worried about the potential for civilians on the ground to be injured or worse. But you asked about it flying over when it gets over the sea. Officials believe that it is heading in that direction. And so the big question is, what happens if and when it gets over the water? Would the U.S. shoot it down or not? Another big question that no one seems to know the answer to is, do the Chinese have some plan here to scoop it back up at some point so that they can collect the data off of it? I think that there are many people in the military who are tracking this very closely, who have the same questions that we do about how this really is going to end.
And Courtney, I know that they supposedly scrambled some fighter jets. How close of a look have we gotten at this balloon via air?
So very close. Mm-hmm. They not only had the F-22s were brought in on Wednesday. There were two reasons for it. I think the big assumption was that they could be used to shoot down the balloon. Defense officials will not talk about how they would potentially bring this thing down if that decision were made. But theoretically, F-22s could be used for that. But everyone forgets the F-22 also has a very sophisticated surveillance capability. So they could fly it up closer and they could get a really good look at it. They also brought in some AWACS, which is another surveillance capability. There are a lot of reports today on social media that there are still AWACS that are in the area. If it is down by Kansas City or was, there's a big AWACS component at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. So the U.S. is tracking it both from the ground and from the air, and I suspect we will see them continue to do that the entire time it's over any U.S. airspace.
Courtney, are officials surprised that the Chinese confirmed that this was their balloon?
Yes, that has been one of the biggest surprises. There wasn't a lot of surprise when they claimed that it was some sort of a meteorological balloon. I think that was expected. But the fact that they owned it as belonging to the Chinese government had a lot of people here in the Pentagon surprised. They were expecting them to say it was some civilian non-government asset.
Well, that brings me to Janice Mackey-Frayer, who's in Beijing. So I want to start with that. I think the biggest surprise here is that the Chinese government is owning the fact that they own this surveillance balloon. What is your understanding of that, number one? And I am curious, how is it being portrayed in the public media out there?
Well, China did admit that this civilian airship belongs to them. They spent most of the day trying to diffuse the tension that has obviously been building with Washington over the past several days. What isn't clear is whether at any point the Chinese side admitted to the U.S. that this balloon had floated inadvertently into U.S. airspace. That isn't clear, but judging from the statement given by the Chinese in saying that they would now talk to U.S. officials to try to resolve or properly resolve this unexpected situation, I think we also heard it in the statements from Secretary of State Blinken when he was talking about the rationale behind postponing his visit here. He seemed offended that this was all happening on the eve of a visit that had months of preparations, high-level talks on a regular basis in order to make a visit like this happen. So he spoke to the audacity of the behavior on the Chinese side in having this literally blow up the night that he's supposed to leave. So the optics around having the Secretary of State sitting in the same room with Chinese officials trying to reset U.S.-China relations, the optics just weren't acceptable. What also isn't clear is whether those talks around replanning this visit are going to get back on track, and what is it going to take to get those talks back on track. You asked about how this is playing in the public opinion here. U.S.-China relations are always a feisty topic of discussion on Chinese social media and certainly in state media. But it was remarkable today on Weibo, which is the social media space. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were talking about this Chinese balloon, and very few people here believed that it was gathering weather data over Billings, Montana.
I'm curious, Janice, do you sense that the Chinese government is upset that Blinken canceled this visit, this is not their intent, or are they not showing any sort of up or down on that decision?
This is an embarrassment for the Chinese government. This is a meeting, a visit that came out of that summit between President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping. This was supposed to be the diplomatic opportunity to try to reset relations, to try to lower the temperature on a range of issues, from trade to semiconductors to Taiwan to Russia. The list goes on and on. So this will be perceived as a foreign policy blunder on the Chinese side. Mm-hmm. Defense officials here haven't said anything yet, but there will certainly be some fallout among foreign affairs officials here that this is turned out the way it has.
So, Janice, is it safe to say that the lack of bravado is certainly delivering the message that they think they made a mistake here?
Well, the day started with official silence. That progressed to a couple of questions at the regular reporters' briefing at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, where a spokesperson said that they were still gathering information to verify it. But they did take the opportunity to say that China does not intend to violate the sovereignty or airspace of any country. And then the statement appeared on the ministry's website, attributed to nobody, making this admission that it was China's balloon, that it had got caught up in the westerlies and it was force majeure, that they had no control over it straying into U.S. territory. But again, not answering to or alluding to the question of if this had strayed into U.S. territory and if there was concern about violating U.S. airspace, why wasn't something said about it before now?
All right. Janice Mackey-Frayer in Beijing, Courtney Cuby at the Pentagon. What a story. I know it's literally the middle of the night for you, Janice. I know you're pulling an all-nighter. This is one of those rare, crazy stories that inspire that. Thank you both. Let me bring in John Brennan. He's the former CIA director and, of course, an NBC News senior national security and intelligence analyst. I also got Richard Haass with us, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's author of the book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. John, I want to start with you on the sort of spycraft here. China surveils us in a number of ways. Satellites, through, we think and fear through TikTok, things like that. What does a surveillance balloon like this get them that their other technologies do not?
Well, Chuck, I think it's unclear. Obviously, this balloon is now hovering 60,000 feet above U.S. territory. And I'm sure it has visual observation capability as well as technical collection capability. And so it's a lot closer to the Earth. And although the Chinese have a pretty extensive satellite coverage in the United States, it's not 24/7 on every inch of U.S. territory. So I guess the question is whether or not there is going to be some type of additional intelligence that they can glean as a result of having this balloon. It also could be that there's no intelligence value to this, that they just are trying to see what the U.S. reaction is going to be,
yeah.
And to see whether or not the way we respond to it provides them some type of framework that there are some disputed areas in East Asia that along near Taiwan, right, and China, both in terms of territorial waters and sea airspace. And so I do think it's been prudent so far for the administration to be closely monitoring this, to acknowledge it, to confront China directly, to cancel Secretary Blinken's trip, but also not to take impulsive action, right, in terms of shooting it down. And that's why I think what they're trying to do is make sure that China understands that this is unacceptable.
Do you think it's the issue of whether or not to shoot it down? How important is it for the United States government to know what that balloon was doing? And the reason I ask that question is it seems to me, I assume the answer is it's pretty important. And the only way to do this, we're going to have to get our hands on this thing.
Oh, I'm sure this is probably the most intensive target of intelligence collection in quite some time.
Yeah.
And so I think a fair number of our intelligence assets are directed against it. It's very clear, as the Pentagon said this morning, that they are confident that this is a surveillance balloon and the Chinese have control of it and that it has changed course. And so I think they are collecting regularly on this. Whether or not they're ultimately going to shoot it down, if they may decide to do that, and looking at the various options there, they don't want to endanger people or facilities on the ground. But I do think that every hour that goes by, they're probably getting, right, more intelligence, both in terms of in the air against that balloon, as well as other intelligence assets that might give them some insight into what the Chinese really have in mind here, and whether or not Xi Jinping himself was personally aware, right, of this balloon flight prior to it. I would think that the Chinese military would have raised this with him if it was an intentional flight pattern. But I guess anything is possible in terms of what the motivation and the initiative was here.
John, I know that there's some things you can't share about sources and methods of how spycraft is done in this country. But I would like to ask in a general question, are surveillance balloons an effective tool anymore?
Generally not, because technology has advanced to such a degree. I don't know the type of sensors and the rest of the payload on this balloon. Obviously, the Chinese are very advanced technologically. Might they have been able to develop some things to be able to map the cyber environment in the areas where some of our air bases and nuclear sites are? Who knows? But again, it's only 60,000 feet above the Earth, which is a lot lower than even the lowest Chinese satellites.
So, I mean, and that's the part of this that I guess it does seem as if that it's not 100% clear what they're up to. And I guess it gets me to, don't we need to know what's on that balloon before we start changing policy and postponing further meetings?
And I think that's what the U.S. intelligence community and the U.S. military is trying to do now, trying to understand as much as possible about what's inside that balloon. And I know that they can access some of that information from a distance. Would you like to get your hands on it? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you can also acquire a lot of insight into its capabilities from afar. And I'm sure that's what the U.S. military and intelligence community are doing right now.
Richard Haass, this didn't happen in a vacuum. And that's, of course, why I think we're all a bit tensed up today. I mean, I had, you know, flashbacks to my childhood and the Cold War and Soviet tit for tats. But I think about just the last, let's just take the last 12 days. Bans on TikTok. We've got a general predicting war by 2025, military bases in the Philippines. There's any number of things that have taken place in the relationship between the United States and China where you could ascribe this balloon as a provocative act, a responsive act, et cetera. What's your sense of where we are and how much of the Cold War flashbacks did you have today?
I'm on a different page here, Chuck. Let's talk about the context. China has been on a decided charm offensive for several months. They've clearly wanted to lower the temperature, improve U.S.-Chinese relations. Blinken was about to be the first Secretary of State to meet with Xi Jinping in, 6 years or so. The idea that they would use this balloon intentionally to be a provocation on the eve of this trip, possible, but it's so inconsistent with everything that is going on of late. If I were the Chinese thinking of provocations, I would think something in Taiwan mm-hmm. would be a much more obvious place to do it. This doesn't seem to me at all obvious. Indeed, I would raise fundamental questions of two things. What was the intentionality here?
Yeah.
Was it to fly this balloon at this altitude at this time? And then the decision making. All I'll say is it does not fit into the larger pattern of Chinese diplomacy of the last few months.
Well, and let's go further on that. It's fascinating to me that the Chinese government has admitted it's theirs. That's not something that you would expect them to do right away. And they're not being belligerent in dealing with this. What does that tell you?
Well, that reinforces my doubts that the administration is reacting correctly. I actually would have gone ahead with the Blinken visit. This is the most important critical relationship of this era of history. There are genuine reasons to be extraordinarily concerned about the trends. I'd begin with Taiwan, also the South China Sea. I've got any number of other issues. That's why you have these trips. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is to put a floor under this relationship. So I just don't see why canceling the trip makes sense. I've seen the speculation online right. about the domestic politics of it. But again, I just wouldn't assume clear either authority behind this or intentionality. There's enough history to look at, including the Cuban Missile Crisis, where things happened that were not necessarily ordered at that right. point by the President of the United States.
And this is why I think it's so important to actually find out what is actually been surveilled, what data are they gathering before we do this. But to go further down this road, if you're the look at this from the Chinese perspective. If they didn't know it, they know now that the one thing that unites our politics these days is being tough on them.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a rare area, shall we say, of bipartisan consensus. You'd be hard pressed to see fundamental differences between the Trump foreign policy toward China and the Biden administration right. towards China. But again, China several months ago, after, you know, given the COVID problems after the 20th Party Congress, they have done a number of things, sent a number of messages to lower the temperature in U.S.-China's relationship. They wanted it as if they wanted to put off
right.
any crisis or confrontation, I think, for several years. So, again, I just think that we've got to be very careful. And what you pointed to, the fact that the Chinese have reacted so quickly, that's fundamentally different from what happened 20 years ago when we had the aircraft incident right. early on in the George W. Bush's administration. The fact that they have not acted belligerently, again, they don't seem to be raising the stakes here. This just putting out there the possibility they do recognize that they made a mistake. It was either a technology mistake or a decision-making mistake, because this does not. It's not consistent with the thrust of what we've seen coming out of Beijing.
And do you expect them to make another gesture to try to make that clear?
It's quite possible. I think now you're going to have back channel talks to basically say, what would it take to get the Secretary of State in Beijing? And I would think there might be some kind of a statement, some kind of an action. The one thing you're not going to see are any more balloons anytime soon, if ever.
John Brennan, former head of the CIA, Richard Haass, head of the Council on Foreign Relations, always a privilege to get the expertise of both of you. Thank you. Joining me now is Congressman Gregory Meeks of New York. He's also the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman, I have a feeling you heard that conversation just now. Where are you in this? And I'm curious, in the briefings you've stated, you know, how provocative do you think this was of an action by the Chinese government? How intentional?
Chuck, I think that I want to make sure that we know. Unfortunately, the House Foreign Affairs Committee has not organized yet. And so therefore, some of the classified meetings that I would be calling for immediately or would like to attend immediately, or even the current chair, we can't call until Tuesday or Wednesday when we officially are organizing. But we are in conversation with the administration. I want to make sure that I get the classified hearing so I know all the facts. What I do know is what they've told us, that there's no imminent danger from this this balloon is danger taking it down just because of damage that could hit the ground. But we've got some, you know, it's concerning to me still because a balloon floating across the ocean and going around into areas of sensitivity for us, you've got to be concerned. And the fact that Secretary Blinken, which I think was the right thing to do, to cancel his trip until we are sure what has taken place and the reactions of China as a result of this balloon being over our territory. So it's a violation of our sovereignty to have a flying object over here in the United States.
We're having a debate about whether we should have allowed it to enter our airspace. But let me ask you this. Should we allow it to leave our airspace?
My gut is no. Let's find out what's in it. I think that at some point it's we're going to track it. And then I believe that we need to know exactly, it's again, one of those things of trust and verify what was there, because we're hearing conspiracy theories and other theories that are taking place from some of my colleagues. And I think that the only way that we eliminate that is if, in fact, we verify that it is what the Chinese are saying it is, a weather balloon. And at some point in my, I would think that we need to have the opportunity to look at it and to examine it. And to see if it is what they said it is or if it's something different. So you could take it out of our space and maybe over the ocean or some other place. I don't know. And thereby inspect it, or ask if the Chinese still have control over it. They can take it down and let us inspect it to see if, in fact, it is what they say it is. So that for the comfort of the American people, as well as so that we don't have an accident that has occurred that brings us to a point of where diplomacy cannot be had.
Do you concur with Richard Haass's assessment that the thing that makes this odd is they've been trying to ratchet down tensions, and so that this doesn't fit. They really wanted this meeting with Blinken, right? So this doesn't seem to fit within that pattern. Do you accept his rationale on that?
Well, I do think there's something of that nature. Having had a conversation with Secretary Blinken a few days ago, prior to his leaving for the Middle East, and then going to China, this would have been the first visit by the United States administration in 5 years. And the conversation at that particular point with, and I know the reason why Secretary Blinken was going over there to tap it down so that we could make sure that there's no lines that are crossed that could cause additional problems. All of the other indications, that I have seen where China has been questioning, for example, its relationship and what has been and its position that it's taken with Russia and Ukraine and the mistakes that the Russians have made. And I think that they are troubled by the downturn in their economy. So it does not fit for me. I agree with that, with where I think that the dialogue has been going and why this by Secretary Blinken was talking about going to China in the first place to tap it down. And I think it's also was encouraging by our allies in the region who wants to make sure that there is at least in giving diplomacy a chance and not immediately jumping into another Cold War or an actual war, as one of the generals has said that we might be in a war in 2024 or something of that nature, which I don't think is the right analysis either.
All right. But isn't it fair to say we're already in a Cold War? We wouldn't be expanding our basing privileges in the Philippines if we weren't, would we?
Yeah, but we're still having the conversation. Again, it's part of trying to make sure that we're secure.
Right.
And we are. And we're still talking about how we can make sure that, there's a lot of trading and other things that may go on, but we want to make sure that we have a stronger supply chain. So we're doing what we have to do to protect ourselves so that we don't have to worry about that. We're ready. But at the same time, you have to have diplomatic conversations. I was a young boy and I remember the Cuban missile crises. So we were ready to do what we had to do, but those topics and conversations were going on all of the time to make sure that there was no mistakes that took place. And fortunately, none did. And we did not have the kind of conflict that some wanted even at that time. So I think that the same thing is happening here, that we have a situation that is tense. Very tense right now. So it's the dialogue and diplomacy and the effort to tap it down. I visited not China, but the region recently, had conversations with several of our allies as well as our military. And they said the diplomatic talks helps them. They will be ready if something goes, as we are, if something goes awry, as we are every place. But diplomacy has to take its place. It has to continue to have a place. That's what the Secretary of State is there for, because he's our lead diplomat.
I want to ask you one other topic that is not on this issue, but it's actually on the first problem that Secretary Blinken was dealing with on his trip before he was heading to China. He was, went to the Middle East. The King of Jordan was here in Washington. I don't want to presume you had a meeting with him or not. I know he was making some visits to Congress as well. Do you think President Biden needs to intervene in trying to tamp things down in Israel and the West Bank? Or is this something that there's not much of a role for the United States to play?
Well, I did have a meeting with the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, and it was a very informative and good meeting. And I know that it's moving in the wrong direction. And what he emphasized is that he thought that we needed to make sure that we tap tensions down, particularly before Ramadan, that if we get the past Ramadan, then, you know, it's tough. And so what I said and what I believe is, number one, we've got to let the people of Israel know that the United States will stand with them, that the memorandum of understanding, because the region is very volatile when you think about, you know, still with Iran and Syria and Lebanon and all, you know, the countries all surrounding it, which endangers the people of Israel. And you also have to know that the Palestinian leadership is very, very weak. So that makes it difficult also.
Right.
But Secretary, again, Biden was there. And I think that we do need to play a role to see if we can be helpful in tapping the tensions down, particularly, you know, with the issues dealing with the mosque. And when I talk to our allies, and I think that we could utilize, for example, many of the Arab countries that's part of the Abraham Accords.
Yeah, the Gulf
that they could play a role in this. And that was the whole idea of the Abraham Accords. They can play a role and help tap it down on the Palestinian side also, since we don't have a strong Palestinian government.
Right.
So that we can have then create that dialogue to make sure that we don't continue to have the rising deaths that are taking place now, unfortunately, on both sides.
Well, that is for sure. I know the Gulf states, sometimes they care, sometimes they don't. And that is a frustration sometimes when dealing with the Gulf states on this front. Congressman Gregory Meeks.
Which is why the Abraham Accords is very important.
It is. It is. I hope they abide by them. Congressman Gregory Meeks, the ranking on House Foreign Relations on the Democratic side of the aisle. Good to see you. Thanks for it. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Pat.
Up next, what's behind this giant January job surge? We're going to ask an expert. Plus, President Biden takes the credit for this low unemployment while blaming Trump for the high inflation. We'll watch him meet the press now.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and Today Show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Strikingly good news. That's what President Biden called today's jobs report. It was a stunner. The Labor Department announced a whopping 517,000 jobs, half a million jobs in a month, were added to the economy in January. It crushed expectations. The unemployment rate also dropped a tenth of a percentage point, 3.4%. That is the lowest in 54 years. Today's blockbuster jobs report comes as our latest NBC News poll shows Biden's approval rating on the economy is terrible. It's 9 points lower than his overall job rating as the country continues to face and not be happy about high inflation.
Here's where we stand. The strongest job growth in history, the lowest unemployment rate in 54 years, manufacturing rebounding at a faster rate than in the last 40 years, inflation coming down, real wages going up, but moderately going up, not going through the roof, the economy growing at a solid clip. Put simply, I would argue the Biden economic plan is working.
Do you take any blame for inflation, Mr. President?
By taking blame for inflation? No.
Why not?
Because it was already there when I got here, man. Remember what the economy was like when I got here?
Joining me now, Steve Leisman, CNBC senior economics reporter. Steve, I'm not going to sit here. You and I could explain the nuances of when inflation began, what's inflationary, what's that I don't want to deal with. What I want to deal with right now is this red hot jobs market. What do you make of this? Is this an outlier jobs report? Are we going to look back at this in 3 months and say, oh, that was an end of the year blip? Or is there something going on here?
Well, I do think we're going to look back on this and see this as a blip, but not necessarily the totality of it, Chuck. It's well to set the stage here for maybe viewers who have been following this tick by tick, which is that, remember, the Fed raised rates by like more than 4 percentage points. The idea being the Fed raises rates, the economy's supposed to slow, job growth's supposed to ease off, wages are supposed to ease, and that's supposed to help bring down inflation. Well, not very much of that has actually come to pass. The Fed raised rates sharply. Everybody thought the economy not only was going to slow down, but maybe even tip into recession. And then you print a number like this. Look, let's say it's even half wrong in terms of, maybe it's just 250,000. That's still ridiculously strong. The normal run rate should be just 100,000 if we're just putting to work the people coming into the workforce. So what it's telling us is a couple things. One is that I think the pandemic is still echoing in the economy in the sense that, I'll give you an example. We have new jobs, 128,000 new jobs in leisure and hospitality. That sector, Chuck, remains below the pandemic level. Mm-hmm. So the hotels, the restaurants, the concert venues, they still have work to do in getting back to where they were. That's fueling job growth. Health and social assistance, healthcare and social assistance, another area. Education, another area, still getting back to the pandemic level. Meanwhile, on another level, some of the tech jobs, some of the warehousing jobs, some of the industries that overhired during the pandemic, they're letting people go. The net in this month was a huge number. Maybe there were some statistical quirks in it. January is a weird month. We hire and fire a lot of people from the holidays. But at the end of the day, job market, I think, remains strong and the economy is strong. And that pushes off fear of recession.
Right. There's no doubt. I mean, it feels like soft landing. Here we come. Except I'm curious about this. How do you expect Jay Powell to react? And I'm going to bring up the issue that you and I bring up quite a bit when we talk about these monthly jobs data or we talk about raising rates is, if we want to tame tame inflation, we need to increase the pool of labor. And our immigration system has just stopped it. It's dead in its tracks.
It is true. I will say this, though. The administration seems to have done a decent job of bringing back the legal immigration path to where it was previously. So we do appear to be getting some relief in that regard. What hasn't happened, though, is the absence of immigrants during the pandemic and, of course, before the pandemic, some of which under the Trump administration policies did create a deficit of workers in this country. That has not been filled. You have retirees retiring at an accelerated rate. You do have an issue of long COVID and people being out of the market. So we do have a labor shortage in this country that, you correctly say, Chuck, we can't fill without bringing in people from abroad because our fertility rates are going down. So the way economics looks at it, Chuck, is you political folks can live any way you want to live. You can have lower immigration or higher immigration. But if you have lower immigration, that's going to mean lower growth.
And it's going to potentially mean higher inflation because of this, of the fact that there's just not enough labor to go around. Steve Leisman, always appreciate you bringing some reality to these numbers. Thank you. After the break, President Biden delivers his biggest political speech since the midterms. It's ahead of the what we expect to be the official launch of his reelection campaign fairly soon. Is it going to be by the end of this month? Panel's next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. President Biden and Vice President Harris are in Philadelphia this afternoon, where they just wrapped up the latest in a series of White House events touting infrastructure improvements. Later today, both the president and the vice president will be speaking at the DNC's winter meeting. It's Biden's biggest political speech since the 2022 midterms, part what appears to be ramp up of his expected 2024 reelection launch. All of this comes ahead of Tuesday's State of the Union address, and our latest NBC News poll shows the state of Biden's presidency, his political health is anything but strong. President Biden's overall job rating sits at 45% in our poll. It's higher than it is in some other polling out there. On the issues, Biden's approval numbers are even lower than that 45% mark when it comes to handling of the economy, foreign policy, and specifically the war in Ukraine. And overall, a combined two-thirds of voters say they have reservations or are very uncomfortable about Biden running for a second term. All right, my panel is here. Joining me now, Eugene Scott, senior politics reporter at Axios. Simone Sanders Townsend, a host of Simone on MSNBC and a former senior advisor to Vice President Harris. And Republican strategist Brad Todd. So, Eugene, the state of Biden's presidency, there are so many data points that should point to he's, I always say, he's really strong inside the Democratic Party right now. But when you look at him as a general election political figure, he looks weak.
And that's worth paying attention to because lots of voters, most voters do not identify as Democrats. And so these are voters that the Biden administration and campaign is going to have to pay attention to make sure they get their message out. That's why you see them talking about infrastructure and what these bills that have been passed in these first 2 years actually are going to lead to in terms of having real life implications for Americans.
You know, Simone, you are no longer there, but I'm sure you hear things. This is sort of this. When you look at his numbers in isolation, if you ignore Donald Trump and the Republicans, these scream primary challenge. It doesn't look good. It does. And yet, that's the thing. Politics doesn't happen in a vacuum, right?
Yeah.
And the comparatives, he shouldn't have anything to fear on a primary front, should he?
No. Honestly, I just think that is fodder for the papers. Mm-hmm. There's no legitimate primary challenge that's going to come to President Biden. I know there's much talk about the DNC winter meeting and the changes that are happening there in terms of the primary calendar, but those changes are really going to affect 2028. And that is where those changes will matter, not a 2024 re-election, expected re-election for campaign for President Biden.
Do you think this is unfixable for Biden? He just basically has to count on, like, look, the public's made a judgment about him, the individual, and he can't fix this right now.
No, it's not unfixable. Look, when President Biden, as he and his allies went through great lengths to make sure people knew in the midterms, was not on the ballot in November, but he will be on the ballot, allegedly, reportedly, coming up in 2024. And I think because he will be on the ballot, it is important people are going out there to make a decision about do they want to reelect he and Vice President Harris. And they will have to make a case about why them and not the other folks.
You know, it's interesting, Brad. I think one thing that everybody has learned based on 2022 is the public sees things as a choice, not a referendum. They saw it as a referendum. I think your side would have had a better outcome. Is that what we're seeing here? It's like we really have to look at this whole picture because you can't judge Biden's health in isolation these days.
Well, the reason Joe Biden will be the nominee, the same reason he was the nominee in 2020, is because Democrats fear the alternatives are less electable.
Right.
And so even though he's run an administration that's much more what Elizabeth Warren would have run than what he promised on the campaign trail, Democrats are still going to think he's more electable than the next best alternative. And so that's why they'll stick with him.
But what does it say about the health of the Republicans that he's this unhealthy on one hand, like if you just looked at it this way in his political health, and yet he looks pretty strong in comparison?
Well, I think, first off, Donald Trump's a known commodity. No one's going to change their mind on Donald Trump, right? And they've already had that election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And you want to run it again, you're going to get something that's pretty close to the same thing, you know, point or two either way. But other Republicans have a chance to grow and have a chance to be better than what Joe Biden is on the ballot and better than what Donald Trump would be against Joe Biden. I think you're going to see that play out over the next year. There's no reason for Republicans to go very fast on it. Mm-hmm. But I think ask us this time next year.
Fair enough. I want to lift up a little bit because we were joking this morning, our morning meeting, that we feel like the 1950s are back. Mm. We're having culture wars. We're having There's a Chinese communist under every under everything. There's this fear. It's bipartisan. What does the politics, when you have this sort of Cold War boogeyman out there these days, that's you, that in some ways is uniting the party and both parties wanting to actually one up each other and who's really tough on China? What's this going to look like in 2023 and 2024?
Well, it'll be interesting. It's, we know we have subcommittees that are going to be focused on this and the messaging coming from both sides of the aisle in terms of what is the priority in terms of not messaging, but addressing these very real concerns, these balloons flying over land and people looking up and feeling very unsafe because they were given no heads up or no warning about it. We're going to have to see how Republicans and how Democrats are going to say what they would do moving forward to stop these types of things happening.
You know, I just find it so interesting. The Biden administration, they like to say, and I'm sure Secretary Blinken said it when he took questions today, our posture with China is competition, not conflict.
Yeah.
And they've been very, even when I was there, it was something we hammered home because going into a predatory, if you will, a conflict posture, with Beijing is not a place I think any American, Democrat, Republican, Independent would like to be. It feels like we are moving to a place where it is conflict.
Yeah, it does.
We'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
I think the Washington wing of both parties is behind on this.
Are they behind or are they ahead? I feel like I say this, you talk to the folks at TikTok and they say the only people that are obsessed about TikTok are Washington. So are they behind or ahead? I don't know.
I think they're behind. Okay. If you surveyed Republicans in the U.S. Senate, they would be less hawkish on China than Republicans in America. I think it's because China's an economic threat and everybody in the working class knows it. They know they're a cultural threat. You see that in the way they treat dissidents in their own party. And they're also a military threat now. And you see that when you see these incidents like this balloon or a month ago when we had a fighter jet get 20 feet away from an American plane over the South China Sea. I think that Washington is actually so in bed with the corporations that can't get out of China fast enough. And yeah. I say that about both parties, that they're behind it.
But I do think that we have seen it's the members of Congress that are taking on TikTok. You know, the millennials and the young people and the people out there in America don't take this away from us.
By the way,
right?
Good luck, TikTok. I think that balloon just ended whatever hope they had.
Truly, everyone should be concerned. And so I do think, though, that the members of Congress are at least recognizing that there is, in fact, a threat here. And frankly, I don't think we talk enough about the Uyghurs, frankly, in our conversations about what is happening, what is happening to folks. Oh, and what the Chinese government is doing. So it's a tight line. It's a tightrope I think people are walking, though, because of how we think about former President Trump, particularly as it relates to COVID-19, how he spoke about the virus, if you will, and how it invited anti-AAPI sentiment. Yeah. And when you hear, if you talk to members of Congress or advocates out there in the AAPI community, it is a concern of demonizing and making all AAPI communities look bad and not specifically talking about Beijing.
I mean, I think if you told me we're going to have another Red Scare, right? And that's what I mean by the 1950s. We had this and there was this, you know, nervousness. Are you a communist? Are you a communist? You know, are you in bed with the Chinese? Are you in bed with the Chinese? It does feel like this is the environment we're about to start living in.
And those scare tactics are going beyond the Asian community. We've seen that Trump campaign moving forward is going to really focus on the LGBT community in terms of education and making that more of a concern. We know critical race theory is going to continue to be ramped up. We're seeing that from, you know, potential GOP presidential candidates like Ron DeSantis. And so these culture war issues that I think many Americans thought we had made progress on, clearly we have not.
Well, what's interesting is how China can both be a culture war issue and a foreign policy issue, can it?
And an economic issue.
Right. Let me ask you this, Brad. Is the Republican nominee in 2024 going to have a detailed tax plan?
Yes. President has to cut taxes.
No, I understand
it's that. God-created Republicans.
But do you really think Republican primary voters care about this, or do they want to know, no, you're taking on the culture
wars? Sure, culture wars have displaced the heat and light of running for office as a Republican, period, right now. As a reaction to the left moving much more further to the left in their campaigns. But I do think you still have to have a tax plan. You still have to have a tax cut. We just had an administration that raised taxes. So
can you be hawkish on foreign policy anymore, though?
Yes. You will see that as China gets more aggressive, hawks will be back. Republican hawks always ascend when there's an actual threat. In times of peace, it's Republican doves that ascend. So watch the hawks.
I think a lot of Republicans wonder, whatever happens to the fiscal hawks? They never seem to actually show up.
Well, Ross Perot ran on that exact reason. You can maybe see that again, too.
Anyway, Eugene, Simone, Brad, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Happy Black History Month, Jeff.
Happy Black History Month. Thank you very much. Still to come, NBC exclusive reporting on the failures in the U.S. immigration system, how the Biden administration has lost track of thousands of migrants across the border in the last 2 years. The reporter behind that story joins me next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Turning now to the ongoing crisis at the border, exclusive new reporting from NBC News reveals that more than 500,000 migrants are living in legal limbo right now, released into the United States by Border Patrol without a court date or charging documents. Thousands of those migrants have been also dropped by the U.S.'s tracking program, rendering them untraceable. To say this is a huge problem is an understatement, not just for the Biden administration and the Department of Homeland Security, but for the hundreds of thousands of migrants who are left without a way to follow the legal path towards asylum if they want to do that. Currently, migrants let into the United States have a year to apply for asylum. And if migrants don't apply within that time frame, then they risk deportation. NBC News' Homeland Security correspondent Joya Ainslie joins me now. So, Joya, this is going to talk about alarming those that are worried about the border, who believe we're just letting people in randomly. This is just going to fuel a lot of concern.
Yeah. There are two ways to look at this, right? I mean, that you could look at it from a national security hawkish perspective, that you've had 800,000 people released into the country without a charging document. And so far, only a little over 200,000 of them have court dates now. This began in March of 2021. There's also the humanitarian perspective. If you're someone who's worried about the rights of people fleeing persecution, now these people are coming in, and by the time they find a lawyer who can help them, they've already missed their eligibility deadline. They could have applied before they actually go before a judge, but it's hard for them to manage that system, navigate it, and figure out who they're supposed to make their case to if they're not doing it in court, where it was typically done prior to this administration.
Is this all folks from that first 3 months of basically, I want to say it was a bit chaotic because you had clearly the changeover in administrations allowed coyotes to say, hey, the doors are going to be open because the rules are changing. And then all of a sudden there was this flood and we had all this. Is this the result of that initial wave?
It's the result. The practice started then, but it hasn't stopped. And now it's getting worse because of funding issues. So if you can remember back March of 2021, it was the first real test for the Biden administration on immigration because you had all these unaccompanied children staying in Border Patrol stations far past the point they should have. So in order to empty out those stations, they started releasing adults and families with no paperwork, with no charging documents. And so they ended up expanding that policy. It covers the whole border. They still do it because, as you know, the numbers overall have only climbed since then, although the child piece has been taken care of to some extent, fewer unaccompanied children, but they continue to release without charging documents with the expectation that they would eventually get a court date from ICE. But our data that we found shows that is less likely to happen than is likely to happen.
So there have always been all sorts of things. Okay, there'll be monitors, or some people have suggested ankle monitors for this. I think that's
They have used them. Yeah, now they use an app. You can check in with your face and your geolocation. But because Republicans are so fed up with Biden's border policies, they don't want to give a dime to anything they're doing. So now they have to drop these people from the tracking program.
No, this is what I feel like the conundrum is. It's like the Republicans upset about the administration, but the administration can't. They just don't have the tools.
They're tying their hands do anything.
They don't, and if they do something, the courts tell them you can't.
Even if it's something that they would give a Republican administration to better secure the border, they're not giving it to the Biden administration until they do more in their view to secure the border.
I mean, it's almost 22. Like, it almost feels like it's an intentional decision.
It could be that it wouldn't be politically savvy for them to give Biden a win at the border. But it is a really tough spot for DHS, but also for these families. And I should point out, this data we're reporting here today, first time it's been released publicly, but Congress gets these numbers. They're aware of this situation. And it's interesting, we're so focused on the border, the numbers every month, we focus so much on that. But now we have a situation because of those numbers where you have all of these people, over 500,000, living in the country, unable to work, unable to claim asylum.
Any evidence that this new Title 42 way is working at all, trying to get people to apply for asylum, say, from Guatemala?
Well, it's definitely bringing down the numbers at the border. I was able to speak to Secretary Mayorkas yesterday with a few other reporters. He says there's been a dramatic drop in January from those four countries, Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua. Cuba.
Right.
There we go. But we'll see. Sometimes there's a dip and then they go back up.
Right. It has been cold. So you never know. Julia Ainslie, great reporting. And thank you all for being with us this hour. We'll be back Monday with more Meet the Press Now.